Chapter 10.
Don't cry.
Jennifer was kneeling in front of Bridge.
You'll ruin your makeup. What does it matter if I ruin my makeup?
Wept Bridge.
I don't have a dress.
I'd given up the search and was now trying to find literally anything else Bridge could put on her body. We must be able to pull something together. Bridge looked up.
Oh, right. I can get married in my hippo pyjamas and Liz's hoodie. Hey,
said Liz.
I got that hoodie at an ecclesiastical retreat. It's practically sacred.
Pulling out my phone, I checked the time. It was 12:10. It's fine. There's just enough time to send somebody back to London.
I'll go,
offered Melanie.
The ceremony starts at 2.
Bridge was attempting to signal despair without touching her hair or face, which made her look like an emoji.
You won't make it back, and then I'll have to get married in hippo pyjamas and a hoodie while I'm missing a bridesmaid.
Liz was already scurrying towards the door.
It's fine. I can go.
Bernadette gave a wary look.
How many mimosas have you had?
Liz ceased scurrying.
Enough that it took me a moment to realise why this would be a bad idea.
A buzzing emanated from my fonula region. It was a picture of a smug man with white hair. A second or two later, Oliver sent Richard Dawkins. A dick, a dork, and a dork. My heart sank. Not because Oliver was at peak Oliver, but because I was going to have to send him away. I called him, and true to form, he answered within two rings. Lucien? Oh, God. I'm really sorry, I said, but I might need you to go back to London.
I'm choosing to believe that if you were breaking up with me, you would have done it in a less bizarre way. Although, knowing you, I'm not sure why I think that.
I wanted to bounce back, but there wasn't time, and this wasn't about me. Bridge's dress got left behind. Can you, pick it up? While driving fast enough that you have a chance to be back here by 2, but not so fast you get arrested or killed.
I will certainly try.
It was his, I don't think this is a good plan, but I'll do it because I love you voice. Incidentally, he had used the same voice when booking tickets for Pretty Woman the musical.
But this is going to be a very tight turnaround.
I'll meet you outside. I hung up, then turned to Bridge. Keys, please. Oliver's going. We all knew he wouldn't make it. But the fact that someone was trying made us feel very slightly better, the operative word being slightly. Because when I'd got back from sprinting to the main house and sending Oliver sprinting to the car park, the mood was teetering between somber and inconsolable.
I don't want to sound pessimistic, began Melanie, but I think we should have a backup plan, because even if Oliver makes it, you still might not have time to get changed.
Bridge made a noise that was an unholy amalgamation of a hiccup, a wail, and a sob.
Fine. I'll get in my pyjamas. There must be something else we can do.
Jennifer had a mimosa in each hand.
What if you wore one of our dresses? Then,
Bridge's voice clicked up half an octave,
I'll be dressed as a bridesmaid at my own wedding. I'll be always the bridesmaid, never the bride, at my own wedding.
We all paced and drank, and thought. Honestly, the drinking wasn't helping with the thinking, but it was helping with the not freaking the fuck out. Eventually, Melanie lifted her head from her hands.
Hang on a sec. We're in a rich old woman's house. She must have something fancy you can wear. There's a suit of armour in the main hall,
Bridge said.
I'll just slip into that.
The great curse of Bridge's life was that she had a tremendous ability to solve other people's problems, but when it came to her own, she could be, and I say this with love, unhelpful sometimes. No, no, I gave her an encouraging shoulder pat. Judy's been married about 20 times. I bet she's got a dozen wedding dresses lying around. There was a pause as Bridge considered this.
So, my choices are naked, pyjamas and hoodies, bridesmaid, or whatever your mum's friend can drag out of her bottom drawer.
Maybe, I admitted, feeling like the worst maid of honour who had ever made honour. But I think four might be the least worst option.
Naked would be a statement, offered Bernadette.
I was edging towards the door. I'll see what I can dig up. Bridget's reply was kind of a burble, but it sounded like an appreciative burble, so, hoping that all this dashing backwards and forwards wasn't turning me into too much of an unattractive ball of sweat, I set off back to the main house. Of course, I didn't know where Judy was, but I was hoping that if I rang Mum, I'd find Judy not far away. She picked up somewhat less quickly than Oliver had, not because she cared less, but because she had a more relaxed attitude to life in general. Actually, come to think of it, I wasn't sure I could imagine two people more different life attitude relaxedness-wise than Mum and Oliver.
Hello, Luke.
I heard the sounds of clinking crockery over the phone. Hi, Mum.
You sound out of breath. Are you getting enough exercise?
Right now, I definitely was. There's a lot to sort out.
I'm sure there is, but you are a young man. A little bit of wedding drama shouldn't be making you so tired.
I've been running all over the place. She made a dismissive Gaelic noise.
When I was your age, I ran everywhere. It is your job. That is the problem. You are at a desk the whole day, and you never get any fresh air or sunshine.
I walk to work.
That does not count. The air in London, it is not fresh at all.
Getting into a debate about air quality in the capital didn't seem likely to help with my current predicament, so I let it slide. I don't suppose Judy's with you, is she?
She is. She is having a croissant.
A croissant?
We are having breakfast.
It's noon. I heard the chink of a knife being set down.
Of course. Who eats breakfast before noon?
A muffled posh voice said something at Mum's end of the telephone.
Apparently Judy does normally because she has to get up to feed the chickens, but I do not think that counts. Chickens get up far too early.
More commentary from just out of hearing.
They cannot be that sensible, or they would not let themselves be eaten. Anyway, mon canton.
She seemed to be addressing me again.
What do you need Judy for?
There's no dress. For a moment, Mum was quiet.
What do you mean there is no dress?
Somehow the bridal party forgot to bring the dress down from London. We were hoping that Judy might have something. I heard Mum explaining the situation, and Judy responding, and the two of them carrying on for quite some while about, from the little I could gather, what a terrible state the younger generation had got themselves into.
I am handing you over,
Mum said at last, and then there was a phone passing sound before Judy assumed telephonic control.
Luke, my boy, spot of bother with the old frock, is that right?
Yes, in that we don't have one, and we were hoping maybe that you did.
Bound to. Old place is full of tat like that.
That was reassuring in some ways, but not in others. I was hoping for something non-tat.
Pish posh, just a figure of speech. Tell you what, let me rustle up some bits and bobs and I'll let you know.
I'd have asked to be handed back to Mum, but Judy had already rung off, so I made my way as quickly as I could up to the main house and hoped they'd come down to meet me. And they had. The courtyard was already swarming with caterers, who, on the whole, had been very good about the last-minute venue change, and was now also graced with two women of a certain age staggering under the weight of more white silk than any reasonable person could have any reasonable use for. I rushed forward to help, and Mum, at least, gratefully unburdened herself, dumping a half-ton of dress into my woefully unprepared arms. Judy, who prided herself on making light of all burdens, just fell into step beside me.
"Can't make any promises," she told me, over a cascade of organza ruffles. "But there's a fair bit for her to choose from, at least. You know, I do miss weddings. Perhaps I should get married again."
She turned to my mum.
"How about it, Odile? It'd make it harder for my bastard relatives to object to your being in my will."
"Please tell me you're joking." I glanced between the two of them. "Mum, you can't just marry your best mate for a laugh." She gave me a disapproving look.
"Don't tell me what I can do, Luke."
Then, to my immense relief, she turned to Judy.
"But I do think he's right. Besides, being married to you would clearly be awful."
Judy gave a won't-stand-for-this disparagement huff.
"I beg your pardon. Being married to me is a wonderful experience. That's why so many people have wanted to do it."
"I'm with Mum on this one," I said. "Marriages are like court appearances. The fact that you've had a lot of them doesn't necessarily mean you're doing them well." That didn't seem to help.
"You're missing out, Odile." "Perhaps, but I wouldn't want to ruin our friendship. And anyway, I do not think I enjoyed being married so much the last time."
I could see that, but I wasn't sure I liked the implication. "Do you not think Dad was a bit of an outlier? Like, he's basically the worst person you could possibly have been married to." Mum gave me a reassuring pat.
"I am sure that is the case, mon canton. And I am sure that if you and Oliver want to be married, you will be far happier with each other than I was with your father. But for me, I think it is a boat that has sailed."
There was no melancholy in the way she said it, even if it was in some ways an inherently melancholy sentiment. And Mum was always very adamant that she was proud of the life she'd lived and the choices she'd made, which was good, because I was proud of them too. And I wouldn't really have minded if she'd wanted to marry Judy, although since it might have put me in line to be Baron Faffle, I would at that point have had to admit that Oliver was right, and I was posher than I thought. We bustled back into the guest room and laid down our various offerings on top of the discarded articles of clothing that Bridget decided she didn't want to get married in.
"Well,"
said Judy,
"here they are. Not all of them are mine, technically. That one was my sister's."
She pointed at a long, flowing gown in an 80s style.
"That one was my aunt's, and that one, I think, I wound up with after a particularly heavy night of drinking somewhere in Monaco. Don't ask."
Bridge came hesitantly over and took a look.
"Oh,"
she said, with a tremor in her voice that should have sent ripples through people's mimosas.
"They seem lovely."
"No need to be polite,"
insisted Judy, for whom "no need to be polite" was practically a family motto.
"Well aware that half of them are ghastly, and the other half are worse, but they are suitable, and certainly better than wearing nothing at all, and I speak from experience in that regard."
The bridesmaids gave her a look of collective interrogation.
"It was the 60s. He was American. There was a lot of mud and flowers," she explained. "All very harmonious, I'm sure, but one does get rather bitten."
Bridge was holding dresses up to herself and checking the mirror.
"I think this one's too short."
"60s again," explained Judy. "Fabulous time."
"And this one,"
she tried another,
"might be too frilly."
"That's the sister. Frilly woman all around."
"And this one?"
Bridge held up a full-sleeved, almost fairy-tale gown with a train that stayed on the bed as she took the rest of it across the room.
"Luke, talk me out of this, because this is exactly the dress I wanted when I was 9 years old, and 9-year-olds have no taste."
Judy had a faraway look on her face.
"Now that is from my 1980s husband. Rich as Croesus, fabulous in bed, otherwise a complete shit."
"Well,"
Mum gave a laconic shrug,
"that was the 80s for you." Yes, I don't know how I'd have got through it if it hadn't been for the cocaine.
I looked at the dress. It was definitely of its era. From a time when, if you wanted to show your friends how much better and happier than them you were, you had to blow a ton of money on something vulgar and expensive, instead of just Instagramming yourself in front of something you didn't really own, like we did in our more enlightened age. It might be the best option. Bridge was staring at herself in the mirror with an expression of profoundly mixed emotions.
Is it wrong that I sort of love it? You can do nothing wrong today, said Bernadette. That's the joy of being a bride.
Jennifer set down her mimosa and moved to a better vantage point.
I think I unironically like it. It's got a Princess Diana vibe. Sign of the times, explained Judy. All wedding dresses had a Princess Diana vibe for a full decade. Wasn't precisely a model marriage, though, was it?
Melanie pointed out.
That wasn't the dress's fault, protested Bridge,
suddenly strangely defensive of the honour of a 40-year-old taffeta gown. Judy clapped her hands.
Well, if you like it, you can absolutely have it. We might need to make one or two tiny adjustments, but that's why Matron taught me to sew all those years ago.
So Bridge got changed, and while it wasn't quite what she'd chosen and didn't fit quite perfectly, even after Judy had gone at it with pins, I had to admit Bridge did look remarkable in it. Sure, it was a bit dated, but it really did make her look like a princess. And since she'd always been one, deep down, I thought she deserved to look like one, too. Chapter 11. By the time the bridal party was lurking outside the walled garden where the ceremony was due to take place, there was still no sign of Oliver, which meant the replacement dress was definitely the dress, and I was going to have to make the honours without my boyfriend. It was barely two, I was already knackered, and all the running around had left its mark. Its sweaty, sweaty mark. So, from a certain perspective, Oliver's absence was a plus, because he wouldn't be able to see, or for that matter, smell me. I was just reflecting on how disgusting I was when the wedding march kicked in. Bridge gave an "I've been waiting for this all my life" squeak, and letting her father take her arm, glided triumphantly through the archway and towards where Tom was waiting. And to give him credit, he looked a lot less shocked than he might that his bride-to-be had shown up in a frock that Cinderella's fairy godmother would have turned down for being a touch OTT. The music crescendoed, and Bridge sailed on, and Bridge's train very much didn't. We'd been aware there was a lot of it, but between me and the bridesmaids, we'd managed to kind of carry it as a bundle, without getting a full sense of its terrifying magnificence. Now, however, it was unfolding like a giant snake in an exploitative B-movie, and because we hadn't had the foresight to stretch it back in a straight line from the door, it was also cornering really badly, meaning it was dragging heavily past the aisle and making aggressive moves at the guests. A hapless second cousin had to snatch her child out of its way. At last, Bridge was at the altar, and the bridesmaids were 25 feet away, wrangling a cascade of silk that had already swallowed 3 chairs.
"Dearly beloved," began Judy in her loudest posh person voice, which was pretty damn loud. "Oh, I say, that's fun, isn't it? I haven't said that in years. We are gathered here today to celebrate the union of this woman, Bridget Dawn Wells, and this chap, Thomas, no middle name, Ballantyne. Then, once the party's over, they're going to go and do the legal bit at an actual registry office."
I could hardly see because I was miles away, but Bridge seemed happy enough, despite the somewhat unorthodox delivery. And Tom had the same look of slightly dazed contentment that every bridegroom has had on his face since the beginning of time. Judy, too, seemed to be having the time of her life.
"Now, I meant to say something about marriage and how jolly seriously you're supposed to take it, but honestly, I've always thought it works best when it's a bit of a laugh. My most successful by far was my fifth husband. We kept each other in stitches constantly. Then, one evening, we were out on his yacht, and he laughed so hard he fell overboard and was eaten by a shark. And as I've told every man I've ever slept with, it doesn't matter how you start or how you finish. It's the bits in the middle that matter. All of which said, I hope this wedding will be a wonderful start to Tom and Bridget's life together.
She paused for about half a second.
Now, vows!
They'd written their own, of course, and they were terribly sweet and terribly sincere. And this probably makes me a horrible human being. I forgot them the moment I heard them. Then again, they weren't supposed to be meaningful to me. They were supposed to be meaningful to Tom and Bridge. Oliver arrived about halfway through, got stuck in the entrance with the bridal party because of the mega train, and, being a far better person than me, took the whole situation impeccably and even seemed to find the vows genuinely moving. After the vows came the rings, ably presented by Tom's best man slash brother Mike, who, unlike the rest of the male guests, had chosen to rock a rose gold suit and was kind of putting the rest of us to shame.
And so, concluded Judy, by the power vested in me by absolutely no bugger, I declare you a legally non-binding man and wife. You may kiss the bride, if you want to be disgustingly American about the whole thing.
To nobody's surprise, they did, in fact, want to be disgustingly American about the whole thing. I glanced sideways and saw Oliver wiping a tear from his eye, which was unfair, because he wasn't as close to Bridge as I was, and had never slept with Tom. At least, I assumed he hadn't. And to my shock and happiness, my brain didn't vanish down a rabbit hole of wondering who Oliver had slept with before we'd started dating, and instead agreed to carry on being genuinely happy for Tom and Bridge in a really straightforward way. It was almost disorienting to have a positive feeling that didn't dredge up a single insecurity or neurosis. But I suppose all the Tom-vanishing, church-burning, dress-losing chaos had worn that part of my psyche down, which just left the part that liked Bridge and Tom and was glad they were married now. The happy couple turned to face their guests and were about to make a joyful procession out of the walled garden when they ran into the train issue. It was taking up the entire aisle, had already made a good attempt at wrapping itself around Bridge's legs as she turned, and was currently dragging through the crowd in quite an ominous way. "If everyone could stand back," I tried, "I think we're going to have to gather and swing. Bride's family, please keep your heads down." It wasn't the most dignified exit in the history of matrimony, especially because a small swarm of over-enthusiastic page boys and flower girls insisted on showering us all with confetti, while we tried to do the sartorial equivalent of turning an 18-wheel van in a residential street. Everything that followed next was a bit of a blur. I remember Oliver's palm at the small of my back, steering me from handshake to handshake and photograph to photograph, where I'm sure my fears of looking like Bridge's stoner cousin were starkly realised. Then he guided me to Judy's surprisingly fancy 16th-century tithe barn for the wedding breakfast. And there, Oliver sat beside me and did the heavy lifting in six identical conversations with other top-table guests that I hardly knew. I even managed to start enjoying the food before I remembered that I was soon going to have to make a speech. And actually, I was okay with speeches. I made them fairly often as part of my job. Except this was different, because it was Bridge. It was Bridge's special day, and she'd remember what I said to her on it for the rest of her life. So, I'd worked hard. I'd worked really hard. Almost embarrassingly hard, in fact, because there was still a part of me that defaulted to the "it's okay I got a D because I didn't study" excuse. And eventually, I'd got the speech to a state where I liked it, where it was all written out neatly on paper and everything, because I thought scrolling through my phone at my best friend's wedding would look bad, and now it was tucked away safely in my breast pocket. In the breast pocket of the shirt I had spent the last 7 hours sweating through, a fact that I only noticed when Tom got to the end of his own speech and said, "The Maid of Honour." I stood. The paper was fine. a little bit wrinkly, although I was regretting having made my notes with one of Oliver's fancy fountain pens. It had felt very grown up at the time, but Biro would have stood up to the elements, well, the elements of my stressed-out body, way better. The speech was now mostly little rivulets of blue, within which I could just about make out fragments of what I remembered as moving-slash-hilarious testimonies to my long friendship with Bridget. Except now they'd been reduced to, "We met at Unity," and "Verdins would be mange." Bugger. Taking a deep breath, I briefly flirted with the strategy of continuing to inhale until I had composed a new, even brillianter maid of honour speech from scratch. But my lungs gave out far too quickly. "What can I say about Bridget?" I asked a room full of glazed-faced guests, and then paused slightly too long, in the vain hope one of them would tell me. "What indeed?" I continued. For some reason, nobody was coming forward to help me out. I felt a light pat on my arm and looked down to see Oliver looking up at me with an expression that, to my surprise, was far closer to saying, "You can do this," than, "Why are you making a fool of me in public?" "I suppose I can say that she's my best friend." "Brilliant start, Luke. Just keep doing facts, and you'll be done before you know it." "And actually, that's sort of everything. She's the best. She's always there for me, even when I'm not there for her. She's good in a crisis, even though she thinks she isn't. She's kind, and she's generous, and she sees the good in people. And I wish I could be more like her." Fuck. Was I tearing up? Bring it back with a joke. "I was going to tell an embarrassing story," I tried, "but I realised it would sound like I was bitter about that one time she stole my boyfriend, which would be particularly petty since she's now marrying him." I turned to the groom. "Tom, yeah, right call, mate. You've got great taste." There. That was a conclusion. I sat down and was just congratulating myself on a job well done, or at least a job not fucked up too terribly, when I remembered the job had a bit more to it. So, like Chumbawamba, I got back up again. I said, "I think I'm also supposed to thank a bunch of people, but as you might have noticed, I've kind of lost my notes, which means I've forgotten who I'm supposed to be thanking, and for what." I briefly wondered slash hoped this was a wedding-themed anxiety dream. But no, I was definitely here, definitely awake, definitely blowing my maid of honour speech. "Whoever you are," I went on with wild optimism, "thank you very much. You're great." I very nearly sat down again when I realised I had to make a toast as well. "To Tom and Bridge, who are also great." There was one of those silences you don't ever want to hear during a speech. "To Tom and Bridget," said Oliver firmly, "who are also great." "To Tom and Bridget, who are also great," the room dutifully echoed. And I sat down faster than I had ever sat down in my life. "Well done." Oliver leaned in to kiss me on the cheek. Thank God that was over. Now I could just sit here and clap politely while the next person... Fuck. I sprang up again. Shit, the best man. Now that I'd actually introduced him, Mike stood up with, I noticed, very unsweated on cue cards in his hands. While I was sure his speech would be excellent, I wasn't quite able to stay conscious for it. Instead, I plopped my head onto the table, narrowly missing the remains of my souffle. And then felt Oliver rubbing reassuringly between my shoulder blades. "I fucked that up," I whispered. I really wanted Bridge to know how much she means to me, and I fucked it up so hard. Oliver levered my face gently out of the crockery. Lucien, you've spent the past 3 months helping Bridget with everything. You organised her non-gender-specific bird party with the slightly offensive T-shirts. You helped track down her fiancé when he went missing. You found her a venue and, for that matter, a dress. And while your speech was... He gave a tactful little pause. Unstudied. It was clearly heartfelt. Yes, but... Putting a hand to my jaw, he turned my head towards Bridget, who was gazing across the table, misty-eyed, and doing heart hands at me. I love you, I mouthed.
I love you too,
she mouthed back. And I absolutely did not cry. After that, things were back to being blurry, not that they'd ever stopped. Once we were done with the speeches and the coffee, the dancing began. And at some point, Bridge vanished and came back in a dress she was supposed to have been wearing all day. It was simple to the point of minimalism, which felt totally unlike Bridge, until you realised it was exactly like her. Just a clean sweep of white satin with a scoop neck and a full skirt. And she did look stunning. Even more stunning, I mean. And I did tell her so. At least, I think I told her so. But the music was loud at that point, and she and Tom had a first dance, and a third dance, and a ninth dance to be getting on with, which wasn't the kind of thing I wanted to interrupt. Sometime around sunset, as the evening buffet was being laid out, I got something that felt a little bit like a second wind, although, given the day I'd had, it was more like a fourth or fifth. Grabbing Oliver by the hand, I dragged him towards the dance floor where my friends were already clustered. And suddenly it was like seeing a decade telescoped in front of me. There were the James Royce Royces, inseparable as always, except now James Royce Royce had baby Jay strapped firmly to his chest. And there was Priya, still doggedly goth-stomping to a song you couldn't goth-stomp to, except the girl who didn't do relationships was now in a relationship with two other women. And there was Bridge, except she was on the other side of the room, in the arms of the man she was going to spend the rest of her life with. Which felt bad for a moment, then good, then something else that was neither. A sort of soft, nostalgic ache for a time you didn't particularly want to go back to, but resented that you couldn't. Then, I noticed Oliver was being slightly resistant.
Lucien, you know I'm a terrible dancer.
You're good at everything, I shouted over the music. It's one of the things I like slash find intimidating about you.
There are many things I am poor at, Lucien, and dancing is one of them.
I kept dragging. Your dancing can't be anything like as bad as my cooking. I waited for a reply, but there wasn't one.
Well? I'm afraid I can't think of a rebuttal. Your cooking really is that bad.
Then dance with me.
Lucien...
Seriously? I stopped dragging and stepped in close. Dance with me. He gave a long-suffering sigh.
If it will make you happy. But be warned, I am not exaggerating. If I were on Strictly Come Dancing, they'd put me with Anton Dubek.
You know, I told him, I would legitimately love to see that. We hit the floor just as the playlist flicked over from Thinking Out Loud to... I want to dance with somebody who loves me. And I did. I did want to dance with somebody who loved me. And I was, which was pretty cool. Although, it turned out that Oliver's dancing was, in fact, as bad as my cooking. All elbows and rocking side to side, like a dad at a disco, which, thinking about it, was the age group we were both rapidly entering. And wasn't that a sobering thought? The soberingness of my thoughts must have leaked onto my face, because Oliver abruptly stopped flailing and stood stock still in the swirl of bodies.
I told you I was terrible at this. If you're embarrassed, it's your own fault.
You could never embarrass me. I put my arms around his neck and kissed him. And for just one moment, it wasn't Bridget's day. It was mine and his and ours. Then the sleeplessness and the rushing around and the fatigue caught up with me all over again, and I sagged against him, and Oliver, being Oliver, led me to a free table at the side of the room without having to ask what was wrong or what I needed. I was pretty sure I only put my head on Oliver's shoulder for a moment or two, but when I opened my eyes again, it was full dark, and Tom and Bridge were saying their final round of goodbyes, which meant that it was no longer a dereliction of duty for me to sneak off as well. So Oliver guided me around one final time, taking me through all the people I had to hug and wave at and say goodnight to before he could finally, mercifully, take me back to the car and drive me home. When we got in, he let me lean on him as I staggered upstairs and helped me undress before I flopped into bed. Then he lay with his arms around me while I murmured whatever came into my head. "Maybe we shouldn't get married," I suggested to the night in general. "It's so much work, and it makes you so sleepy." Oliver pressed a kiss to the back of my head.
"Whatever you want, but rest. You deserve it."
I wasn't sure I did, but I was too exhausted to protest. I shut my eyes and let the cotton wool darkness swallow me. Part 2. Mr. Miles Edward Green and Mr. John Joseph Ryan. The Archways, Shoreditch, 26th of June. Chapter 12. "What," I asked Alex Twaddle, "do you call a deer with no eyes?" Alex blinked.
"I don't know," he said gamely. "What do you call a deer with no eyes?"
"No idea."
"Oh." Alex blinked again. "That's disappointing. I thought it was a joke."
He opened Bing.
"Shall we Google it?"
"Fuck me." "No, Alex, it's a joke. The joke is no idea. Because it's a deer with no eyes."
"Yes, I know it's a deer with no eyes, and I know you've no idea what it's called, but you've got me wondering now."
"Alex, it's called a no..."
"I say," cried Alex, with fatal enthusiasm. "Reese, you wouldn't know what the technical term for a deer with no eyes is, would you?"
Reese, influencer, walked into the office, with his phone at the optimum streaming angle.
"Not sure that's really the kind of thing there's a technical term for, Luke."
"I don't want to know what the technical term is," I yelled. "I just said, what do you call a deer with no eyes? No idea." He considered this for a moment. And then, of all the many ends of the many sticks in front of him, he grabbed tightly to the wrong one.
"So it's a specific deer, then? Are you adopting a deer?"
"No, Reese, I'm not adopting a deer. Where would I keep a deer?"
"This is tragic."
Alex actually had a slightly teary look.
"The poor little deer with no eyes. Was it pollution? If you can't keep it at your house, Luke, I'm sure we've got room on the estate, though the other deer might bully it."
Just when I thought this had got as out of control as it could possibly get, Reese Jones-Bowen addressed his increasingly vast audience.
"Hello, aristocrats. Got an exciting new conversation challenge for you. My friend Luke is adopting a deer with no eyes, who's going to live on Alex's estate, and we need to find a name for him. Or..."
He glanced back at me.
"Or is it a her or some kind of non-binary deer?"
I flailed like I was Oliver dancing. "It's not a non-binary deer. It's a completely hypothetical deer."
"So far," Reese told me, "the names that are winning are Deirdre, Deary McDearface, and Steve."
"I might go with Steve," I suggested, hoping vainly that a quick surrender would end my suffering. Reese was still checking his feed.
"Oh, somebody here has suggested you call it No Idea, which I think is very inappropriate. I mean, you can't make the poor thing's disability its whole identity.
I was just about to flee back to my office when Professor Fairclough descended from the upper floors.
I heard a commotion, she said. Has there been a disturbance?
I think this place is a disturbance, I replied.
Oh, Professor!
Alex looked up excitedly.
You all know. What would you call a deer with no eyes?
Capreolus caecus, clearly.
She shrugged.
Assuming it was a trait endemic to the species. If it was suffering from an unknown disease, I'd call it Subject One.
You can't call Luke's poor little deer Subject One, protested Alex.
Oh, God, why did I keep doing this to myself? There is no deer. Everyone stared at me in aggrieved confusion.
Then,
Alex looked genuinely wounded.
Why did you ask me what to call it?
You know something? I threw my hands in the air. I have no idea. Before the situation could degenerate any further, I escaped into my office. Of course, I say escaped. But the moment I sat down, I saw that I had an unread email from Barbara Clench.
Dear Luke, unfortunately, your request contravenes CRAPP's new policy regarding the photocopiers. In order to avoid a repeat of last month's incident involving Alex, the feed tray and the fire engine, it has been agreed by the directors that no changes may be made to the photocopiers under any circumstances without the approval of a qualified engineer. I see no reason to make an exception for you. Kind regards, Barbara.
It had been a while since I'd been in a back and forth like this with Barbara, and in her defence, it was generally a good idea to have a nobody touch the machines policy when Alex was around. Although possibly Alex don't touch the machines would have got more to the heart of the issue. But this was getting in the way of my ability to do my job. Dear Barbara, while I understand the value of this policy in broad terms, the photocopier is out of paper. If we need to call an engineer every time the copier runs out of paper, it might prove unnecessarily expensive. Kind regards, Luke. I didn't expect that to be the end of it, and it wasn't.
Dear Luke, the current policies have been set by the directors, and I do not have the authority to alter them. The rules are clear. You are not to tamper with the photocopiers in any way. Kind regards, Barbara.
Dear Barbara, then can you please call an engineer? The photocopier is out of paper. Kind regards, Luke.
Dear Luke, I have spoken to our reprographics supplier, and they have told me that their engineers can only be dispatched to deal with genuine malfunctions. Kind regards, Barbara.
Dear Barbara, fantastic. Then can I please be permitted to restock the paper? Kind regards, Luke.
Dear Luke, you may not. The policy remains clear on this matter, and I do not have the authority to alter it. Kind regards, Barbara.
Dear Barbara, do you not see that this is a problem? Kind regards, Luke.
Dear Luke, if you disagree with the policy, you may bring it up at the next directors' meeting in September. Kind regards, Barbara.
Dear Barbara, and until September, we're just not going to use the photocopiers at all. Kind regards, Luke.
Dear Luke, the average UK office worker prints 10,000 sheets of paper a year, of which 6,800 are wasted. This is equivalent to 4.8 trees per person. As an ecological charity, CRAPP should be doing its best to reduce printing and photocopying, not enabling it. Kind regards, Barbara.
Dear Barbara, while I'm sure we all agree we should reduce waste, I can't help but feel that there's a more elegant solution than turning our office photocopier into the world's most boring modern art piece. Kind regards, Luke.
Dear Luke, the current policies have been set by the directors, and I do not have the authority to alter them. Kind regards, Barbara.
I was just resigning myself to 3 months of working in a paperless office with none of the technologies that made paperless offices actually work when the door opened and Alex Twaddle stuck his head in. "If this is about the deer," I began.
"No, no, fully acknowledged that the deer was a cruel hoax."
I made a frustrated noise at the back of my throat. "It wasn't a hoax. It was a joke."
"Luke,"
Alex folded his arms,
"I don't think it's at all funny to mock a deer with a serious disability."
"There was no deer."
"It's the principle of the thing. And if you're going to be insensitive, I'm not going to invite you to my wedding."
The old me would have thought if I ever needed encouragement to be insensitive, this was it. And frankly, the new me thought the same. "You're getting married?" I asked. Alex's sleepy eyes flashed shock at me.
"How do you know?"
"Oh, for fuck's sake. You just threatened not to invite me to your wedding, and that would be a weird thing to do if you weren't getting married. Also, you've been engaged for at least 2 years."
"I say, well deduced. That dashed clever boyfriend of yours must be rubbing off on you."
"Clearly."
"Anyway, Miffy and I thought we should, you know, do the decent thing. Being engaged is smashing and everything, but one is technically supposed to get married at the end of it. Besides, can't keep a girl waiting around forever, and neither of us are getting any younger."
Crap. I'd reached the stage of my life where people who were younger than me were worrying that they were getting too old for stuff. "I mean," I said, "you've still got plenty of time, haven't you?" "Really?" And now what was I doing? Why was I trying to talk Alex out of marrying the gorgeous heiress fiancée he'd probably, although knowing Alex not necessarily, been engaged to for years? He shrugged.
"Well, maybe. But you never know what could happen. You could get trampled by a horse tomorrow."
"In London?"
"No, but back at the house. Happened to my Uncle Freddy. 3 days before his wedding, wasn't looking where he was going. Wandered into the middle of a polo match, absolutely flattened. Or my Uncle Simon, 2 days after his wedding, celebratory shooting party. Wife mistook him for a pheasant."
"Did she?" I eyed him carefully. "Because that sounds like a murder to me."
"Oh, no," exclaimed Alex. "She was terribly upset, poor thing. So upset that my Uncle Timothy had to move into the house to comfort her. And when she wasn't feeling better a year later, they moved to Tokyo."
"Big fan of Japanese culture, was she?" Alex screwed up his face.
"I think it was something they didn't have that they were more interested in, strangely."
"An extradition treaty," I suggested.
"That's the blighter. Anyway, fearfully nice lady. I do hope she comes back to see Miffy and me tie the knot."
"I wouldn't pin your hopes on it."
"I suppose it is a long way."
He paused.
"But you'll come, won't you?"
"Technically, you haven't invited me yet."
"The proper invitation will be along in a day or so. So sorry at such short notice. Dashed thing. It turns out a surprising number of people aren't in Debrett's."
He gave me a faintly chiding look.
"You should get that seen to, old boy."
"I'll get right onto it," I said. "Right after I get my seat in the Lords."
"I wouldn't bother. It's all political now."
I decided to let that one die on the vine. "Thanks for the tip." Alex beamed.
"Any time. Well, not any time. Not if I'm asleep, for example, or when I'm in the bath. Chap should never talk politics with another chap in the bath."
"What should? Why was I asking this? What was wrong with me? Another chap talk about with another chap in the bath?"
"Rugger."
"Noted." Alex gave me one of his vague, amiable looks.
"In any case, do save the date, won't you? I mean, when I send you the date. I'd tell you, but can't remember it off the top of my top."
"Shall do," I said. "Thanks." And then Alex drifted away, leaving me with a nebulous sense of unsettlement. Obviously, I was happy for him. At least as happy as I could be for a man who, when you thought about it, embodied literally everything that was wrong with the British class system. But I was also... I don't know. This was a lot of... Yeah. It was kind of like I was at a station, and everyone else was getting on trains. Or like I was at a restaurant, and everyone else was on their main course, while I was staring at the departure board. Or menu. Or... Ugh, fuck. This made no sense. I was happier than I had ever been in my life. So why did I feel like I was failing? Chapter 13.
We still don't have to do this, said Oliver, as we got off the tube in Shoreditch, on our way to do this.
This being attending the wedding of the man who'd ruined my life. Well, ruined a bit of my life. A bit of my life that had seemed quite important at the time. I took his hand decisively, and definitely not desperately. We do. I mean, I do. I mean, it's a closure thing. Look, I think I need to, okay? And Oliver, being Oliver, just said, of course. The problem was, I wasn't actually sure why I needed to. I was calling it closure because that seemed a healthy and usefully vague label I could point other people at. And maybe it was closure. Maybe after tonight the little box in my head that had Miles written on it would finally be closed, and I'd never have to think about him, or what we'd been to each other, or what he'd done to me, ever again. Besides, if it wasn't closure, what did that mean? What was I trying to prove? Or, if I wasn't trying to prove anything, what was I looking for? Or, if I wasn't looking for anything, what the fuck was I doing here? Fuck. It turned out that Miles, true to form, had chosen to get married in an abandoned railway tunnel lined with artisanal graffiti. It would have been a cool and daring choice, except this particular abandoned railway tunnel lined with artisanal graffiti was a fully licensed venue with its own bar. Right now, the exposed brickwork was splashed with rainbow-coloured lights because it was going to be one of those gay weddings.
We still don't have to do this, said Oliver, and this time I was pretty sure it wasn't for my benefit.
Sorry, I whispered. At least 12 people I know have already seen me. And while I think no showing at your ex's wedding is fine, about facing it isn't. Mercifully, Miles and Jojo were far too trendy to do assigned seating, much as I'd enjoyed having a confused usher come up to me at the James Royce Royce's wedding and ask me, groom or groom? Which meant Oliver and I got to skulk at the back like we hadn't done our homework. I kept hold of Oliver's hand, partially because it was nice, and partially just to apologise. He leaned in slightly.
I bet you £50 they have a drag queen officiating.
Okay, this was going to be way more fun if I'd accidentally brought mean Oliver with me. I am absolutely not taking that bet, I whispered back. Then I paused. I'd put it off for as long as I could, but I had eventually cracked and web-stalked the guy my ex was marrying. And that led me down a hell of a rabbit hole, because he was a fucking YouTuber, with a subscriber count in the millions. He had several channels dedicated to various areas of his life, including a new one just for wedding prep, but his main source of influence revolved around videos of him looking fabulous and claiming you could look similarly fabulous if you followed his tips and bought the products his sponsors paid him to recommend. Point was, there was no way he was going to be upstaged by anyone on his big day. Actually, I said, you're on. And my instincts proved dead right. Although, to be fair, Oliver's did too. Kind of. To a sudden round of applause, the minister entered, and took his place on a stage that had been meticulously designed to look hastily improvised. Of course, I say minister. What I meant was tiny drag king in full leather daddy get-up, wearing a T-shirt that, from the back of the room, I could just about make out read, "Gender is over." "Shit," I whispered to Oliver. "That's Roger Moore."
"He's looking good for a dead man in his 90s.
I gave him a look. Not Roger Moore as in the fourth best Bond actor. Roger Moore, as in sexually penetrate with greater frequency. He used to be one of our best mates back in the day. Oliver looked like he was about to ask a follow-up question when Roger began his typically bombastic introduction.
"Dearly beloved," he began, "in case you haven't noticed, this isn't going to be a traditional service. We aren't in a church, and I'm certainly not a priest. But ladies, if you want to see God, call me after the ceremony."
He rode the laughter a bit before he continued.
"We are gathered here today to celebrate the love of two totally fucking amazing people."
And I sort of checked out after that, because I was having feels. Complicated feels. Because for all I could snark about the indie venue and the rainbow lights and the drag minister, this had been my world for years. Until one of the fucking amazing people we were here to celebrate had blown it up.
"And here they are,"
Roger finished with a stagey snap of his fingers. All eyes turned to the back of the room, where Miles and Jojo entered from opposite sides of the archway. Linked arms, with a precision I suspected they'd practiced at least 112 times, and proceeded down the aisle. A well-hidden speaker system kicked in, and "Slip Away" by Perfume Genius played over the procession, while two professional cameramen captured the whole thing for what I was willing to bet, and a sneaky check of Jojo's Twitch channel confirmed, was a live stream. And I did have to admit that they both, in their radically different ways, looked great. Irritatingly great. Miles was dressed in a very traditional suit that made him every inch the perfect groom, and even managed to make his hipster beard less risible. Jojo was in full makeup, with rainbow eyeshadow out to the temples, and wearing a silk tailcoat over a denim shirt and a black skirt flowing with organza. Fuck. The man who'd ruined my life was a spread in gay hello, which I guess would be bona tavada your eek. The ceremony that followed was irreverent, joyful, and occasionally vulgar, but it was also depressingly touching. Miles and Jojo were clearly head over heels for each other, and the guests, me and my cynical boyfriend aside, were clearly head over heels for them and their future happiness. "Jojo," said Miles, looking legitimately glistening-eyed as he kicked off the exchange of cloying sincerity that made you really miss love, honour and obey. I mean, sure, it was outdated and misogynistic, but at least it was short. He swallowed. "Jojo," he tried again, "when we met, I was in a dark place." "Oh, poor you. If you give me some of your 50 grand, I'll buy you the world's smallest violin." "But," Miles continued inexorably, "you showed me how to be happy again. You came into my life like a bolt of sunshine. You make me feel safe and loved and seen. And I know that I'm a better person when I'm with you." Considering the kind of person he'd been when he was with me, that was a pretty low bar. "You've given me so much. Your generous spirit, your dauntless heart. You've filled my days with joy and my nights with a frankly astonishing collection of fancy lube." Pause for laughter. Eye roll. Miles continued gazing at his husband-to-be with intense devotion. "I love you, Jojo. I always will." I stole a look at Oliver. It was his blankest face, and that was oddly reassuring. Miles, Jojo gazed back, you're my rock. You're the best, kindest man I've ever known. Except, of course, for my amazing Patreons. I'm kidding, I'm kidding. Another pause for laughter. Although I like to think he wasn't joking, Miles deserved to marry a man with sponsored vows. I was lost when we met, Jojo went on, but you found me. I'd forgotten how to believe in myself, but you remembered how to believe in me. Mean Oliver leaned over and whispered as softly as he could, have I developed spontaneous aphasia, or are they just saying words at random? You should object, I told him. You know it doesn't work like that. He paused, especially because this is a wedding. I was lonely, Jojo went on. And now I'm not, because I've got you, and I know you'll always be there for me, and you've made me happier than anyone ever has. Oh, God, he was crying, and not in an artful gets-me-clicks way. He actually meant every word of this, and as usual, I was being a prick. He dabbed at his eyes, smearing his rainbows a little, but looking so offensively radiant it didn't matter. I love you, Miles, and I always will. Pause for oars. For about 90 seconds, I felt real bile rising up in my stomach, because people were awing for my arsehole ex and his jailbait boyfriend. Sorry, jailbait spouse. I'd sort of convinced myself that the wedding would prove to me that Miles was nothing but a tired hipster chasing a YouTube trophy husband, and the ceremony would just be a self-congratulatory wankfest to cover their sham of a marriage. Except, in the end, the ceremony had been a self-congratulatory wankfest that had been really sweet and meaningful. And rather than being doomed forever, it was clear that Miles and Jojo kind of had something. And I was, once again, the one left behind with nothing. Wait. No, I wasn't. I hadn't been that for years, even though I'd believed I was for quite a long time. It had been a pisser of a journey, but I was slowly working out that I was more than the shitty things that had happened to me. And one of the best things that had happened to me was sitting right there, helping me mock the vows at my ex-boyfriend's wedding. Which, and maybe I was an overcompensating person or just a rubbish person, was some hashtag relationship goals shit right there. I gave Oliver's hand a little squeeze. I could do this. I could totally do this. I was fine. Well, fine-ish. Finoid. Definitely heading in a finular direction. Maybe.